Good afternoon. I think we'll get started. My name is Bill Fry. I'm Dean of the Faculty, and I welcome you to this faculty forum on academic rigor and student support. This is part of the response to President Scorton's challenge to define the way forward concerning the student experience at Cornell. There have been very many responses to that challenge, to the way forward. I suppose one of the most visible is the construction of the temporary fences on the bridges. But in addition to that, there are many other things happening that can have, I think, a very significant effect. On the faculty side, actually the whole university side, there is a group of people working on changes to the academic calendar. And they have just published their list of principles, and I think they will come forward with some substantial recommendations for changing the calendar before the end of the semester. Many of you are aware of the Faculty Senate resolution on work over spring break. In contrast to popular opinion, it was not that there was no work over spring break, but just not additional work over spring break. Last spring, the Faculty Senate passed a resolution concerning advising, and that seems to be a very common theme, that we need to encourage personal interaction between faculty and students. The Student Assembly passed a resolution recently calling on the faculty to have a greater impact, and there's a small group of faculty who are dealing with that resolution and trying to figure out how to proceed with that. In addition, the Graduate and Professional Student Assembly passed a resolution dealing with mental health of students, and that small group of faculty also is dealing with that issue. This particular forum is stimulated by three student groups, the Black Students United, the Student Assembly, and Cornell Minds Matter. This forum also has been endorsed by the Council on Mental Health and Welfare. Our format today is that there are six speakers, two students, and four faculty. They are to speak up to 3 minutes each, and then we will turn the discussion over to the audience, and members of the audience can make comments or ask questions, bring up for discussion. You guys are limited to 2 minutes, so no long speeches. And then we'll just continue on that. We expect to go for an hour or so, depending on how things develop. I'd like to introduce the speakers, and I'd like to do that in the order in which they will speak, and I'll do them all at once, and then they will speak sequentially. First is Sarah Gumai. She's a senior in industrial and labor relations, and she's from the Washington, D.C. area. This year, she serves as the chair of Black Students United, and she's been heavily involved in the search for a new assistant vice provost for academic diversity. Her interests lie in increasing enrollment, graduation, and achievement rates for underrepresented minorities. She's pursuing a career in higher education and will be a 2011 core member for Teach for America in New York City. Next is Kathy Gleason. Kathy is an associate professor in landscape architecture. She's a specialist in the archaeology of past landscapes, particularly design features such as parks, gardens, and fields. And what she really wants to do is to go to Rome and visit there, where she was last week. Her field research has been conducted recently in India, Jordan, Israel, and Italy, with applications in New Mexico, India, and Jordan. She's our second speaker. Our third speaker is Professor David Grease. He's Associate Dean of Engineering for Undergraduate Programs. And David tells me that he got his PhD at MIT, which is the Munich Institute for Technology. And I asked if the instruction was in German, and he said there was no instruction. David is a computer scientist. His interests are in programming methodology, in particular the formal development of programs in related areas such as programming languages, programming language semantics and logic. And he's interested in how logic and formalism can be taught as a useful tool at the freshman and sophomore college level. Our next speaker is Eric Przeszewski. He's a senior in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. He hails from Buffalo. He's studying nutrition and microbiology. He has been actively involved in the Cornell community as a resident advisor, teaching assistant, tutor, and lead instructor for Cornell Outdoor Education. He has been involved in research both on and off campus through the Cornell Presidential Research Scholars Program and plans to complete his honors thesis based on data collected in India last year. After graduation, he will spend a year working for Cornell pursuing nutrition research in Rwanda before studying medicine at Columbia. Jed Sparks is next. He's an associate professor in ecology and evolutionary biology. His research focus is to understand the physiological characteristics of plants and microbes that control the interaction of plant and soil communities with the atmosphere. He's interested in how terrestrial ecosystems respond and contribute to environmental conditions. And the underlying motivation for that research is to predict the response of ecosystems to human-driven alterations. And his PhD is from Washington State with a bachelor's degree from the University of Utah. And our final speaker is Shaukat Tuwara. Shaukat received all of his degrees from Penn. He's an associate professor of Arabic literature and Islamic studies. His interests are classical and medieval Arabic literature, modern Arabic poetry, the Quran, and the Indian Ocean. And so our first speaker is Sarah.
Well, I'm really glad you guys are already clapping. So I really want to thank everyone for coming out, especially faculty with their heavy schedules and students who also have a lot to do. This is a student-led initiative. We wanted to see faculty and students come together and talk about the classroom experience as well as how we can link it to the outside classroom experience. That's a discussion that we rarely have, but yet when we talk about mental health and things of that nature, it's really important. On my behalf, I should say that I'm speaking from personal experience, and I'm speaking from things that I've observed throughout my 4 years at Cornell. And I think that faculty can build student resilience as well as students themselves. And one of the things that I've observed is taking an approach to where faculty recognize the diversity that exists at Cornell and embrace it. For example, I've had faculty members talk about holidays before they began a classroom, or talk about incidents that might happen in Japan or different areas where they realize that students are affected by it, and instead of, you know, just continuing with the coursework without recognizing these things, it takes a lot, and it's very appreciated if faculty take a moment and reflect on these things. I strongly believe that Cornell's diversity is something to be garnered, especially in the classroom. We can't just talk about econ all day and act like nothing else in the world happens. I think that students will really appreciate that and feel as if they're a part of the classroom experience when faculty realize that, hey, like, my students are from different backgrounds and this is the way that I can reflect and acknowledge that. And that for me has worked pretty well. And another thing is not just diversity in terms of culture, but also disability. I've been very involved with different disability initiatives on campus and off campus. And there are a lot of times where students feel alienated by the fact that faculty just might not know that there's a disability. And although it's on the syllabus, what can faculty do to take it a step further? What can students do to recognize that, hey, there might be a student who might not hear as well, but not might be legally deaf, and what are the accommodations available? Maybe it's not just longer test time. I feel as if the more steps that faculty and students take to be inclusive in the classroom, the easier the course load will be, and the more effort that students will put forth into their schoolwork, and it will build upon that resiliency that we're always talking about. And then the last thing I really wanted to touch upon is competing priorities. A lot of us in this room are really busy. Most of us are leaders in our fields and leaders on campus. And what if a student is planning a big event and they can't get that paper turned in on time, or they're not really focusing on classwork as they usually are, and it might be because they're planning something. It might be the person's planning a concert for CCC or something like that. What can faculty do to engage that and not just, you know, see it as the classroom experience versus the outside classroom. So those two things compete. The way I've done it is go to office hours and talk to my professor about my outside classroom involvement. And I had one professor, Professor Lieberwitz, who stopped and made me do pliés because she's a dancer. And she said, well, first let's focus on you and how you're feeling and what you're doing. And she took the time to talk to me and advise me on my activities and then tell me that my schoolwork comes first. So that's an important message, but at the same time, it also needs to be acknowledged that students are doing really great things on campus, things that attract other students from all around the world to come here, and it's not just the classroom experience that makes Cornell a great institution. So faculty and student can be partners in that and just engaging those two worlds and making them work and creating balance for each other. And so that's my general thing. Definitely make it a more inclusive classroom. It will make students feel included, just as the word states, and appreciated. And with that comes, you know, acknowledging leadership and outside competing priorities and trying to work between those two things, training TAs to recognize different types of students and different types of involvements and knowing what's going on, not only in the classroom, but at the Cornell at large, reading the Cornell Daily Sun, and just learning more. So thank you.
Let's see. Is this a good distance? Good. Those were wonderful remarks. In my participation with the question of stress on the University Faculty Committee of the Senate and the Mental Health Advisory Council, as well as through my years of teaching and advising, I have been focusing recently on what faculty can do to advise both in the classroom setting and as faculty advisors that maybe peer advising can't do. I think most students turn to each other as much or more than any particular faculty member, and perhaps even more so with electronic social media. On the other hand, what is it a student can turn to a faculty member for, particularly in dealing with stress? And reflecting on this, I would like to see how the faculty member can guide through this question of hard work. What's the difference between hard work and stress? I think most people are here because they work hard and love it in some way, but also that's the area around which we're seeing a great deal of stress. And one area that I think we can work on through teaching and through the classroom situation, and it's something for faculty to reflect on, is how we can guide students through the ways in which the classroom experience parallels what they'll experience out in their professional life. Learning your own workplace preferences can help with stress at any time of life, knowing what situation you work in the best. Do you prefer to work within a team or independently? Do you like a lot of structure and direction, or do you chafe to and long to head off on your own, or do you prefer to be the leader, or some of the above? Does a vibrant, busy environment support your creativity, or do you need quiet, spare surroundings to be really productive? I think the variety of professors and classroom formats at Cornell are often replicated in the work world or in the academic world as you go on. And so learning to know where you thrive and under what kinds of authority you thrive can give you insight into the right kind of job or graduate school and offer lessons in the future. So while you're at Cornell, seeing that professor less as a terrible teacher and perhaps more as a lesson in the kind of boss you might not thrive under can, I think, start to ease the stress a bit. What are the different kinds of excellence in your chosen field of study? Is there only one kind that requires top grades and a single set of performance criteria? And how does this align with your own abilities and interests? Well, on the one hand, you don't want to be too comfortable, particularly as an undergraduate. This is a time for growing pains. You also should be able to work out during your time as a student whether you're using your best skills and abilities. And I think that's something that faculty can help you gain some perspective on. And so to develop this kind of understanding, I think requires that students take the time to shed the kind of grinding demand you've been under to get the grades to come into college in the first place, and maybe stop and think about maybe not getting all A's. You know, maybe what you're doing as an extracurricular activity is so important, you'll get a B+ for the first time in your life, or a B. And that maybe when you go to graduate school, they'll see in your academic record that you have done this diversity of things. But in terms of stress, I think on a day-to-day basis, just starting to see where you work best. You know, instead of just working to the grade and working to other people's expectations, you've had so many of those. And how can you take time in your courses and in your extracurricular activities to find out how you work the best, what formats you work the best in, what kind of boss you might, or professor you work the best with. I think that requires stepping off the treadmill a little bit and testing out different waters for yourself. I think this is where the faculty can offer that perspective. And I just wanted to give one example, and I'll stop, which is that I had a student recently who loved really working hard, really the grind, and her father suffered a very early heart attack in his late 40s, and suddenly she faced a lot of pressure from home to not work so hard, and came to doubt even that she should be working as hard as she was. And this was a period where we really got to talk about whether she loved this hard work or whether she was doing it to please someone else. And it was a time the faculty could work with her to look in the long run and see that she actually, in her 20s, she loved working that hard, and she could do it then. And then maybe she could start to wind down and look at her other priorities in life. And so maybe just using faculty to have that long perspective, have that knowledge of the workplace, and to help even give you permission to just work really hard when it's stressful to think about doing that. Thank you.
I'm going to give the viewpoint of a faculty member. I've been teaching Computer Science 1110. That's the first programming course for many years now. It's a difficult course to teach. I don't have time to tell you why, but one of the problems is that it has 150 to 250 students in it each semester. So it's very difficult. It's difficult to get over that feeling of anonymity in it. I try very hard in many ways to make students think that I care. Doesn't matter whether I care or not, they have to think that. I'm joking, of course, because I wouldn't be doing these things if I didn't. You have to do everything you can to establish a rapport with these students. You have to get them to believe that you are on their side, that it's not you giving grades and them doing things to get good grades. You're working together for a common purpose. This is difficult with so many students. I'll tell you a few of the things that I do. One of them is, last semester I held a weekly lunch where 5 to 6 students could come have lunch with me in the straight. Cornell paid for my lunch. That was very nice. They got to know me better. I got to know them. Grades. This is a very competitive atmosphere. The students have to know that we don't want to give them grades. I'd rather not have to do that. That the real reason for the test is to give them feedback on what they didn't learn and to feedback to me on what I didn't teach well. So, for example, we give the prelim in the evenings. We have two of them. It ends at 9 o'clock, 7:30 to 9. We start grading, and by 12:30 that night, they can see their grades on the website, and the next day they're handed back in the lecture or the lab. We eat a lot of pizza. This is great. They get feedback immediately on what they've done wrong, what they've learned, what they haven't, and so on. On this business of prelims, I think we have far too many of them, and they're far too long. Some courses have 3 prelims during the semester. You don't need that in order to understand what the students don't know. 2 is enough. And when I give a prelim, I aim for that first student to walk out after 45 minutes, and then there'll be a slow but steady people leaving. And after an hour and a half, there may be a handful, maybe 10% still there. So they know that the test wasn't too long, and the reason they're in there longer is because they didn't know the material. The workload is often a stressor. Faculty have to be aware of this, and I know that some aren't, especially in the science and engineering courses. I don't have any statistics on it, but I believe that faculty acting like theirs is the only course is one of the biggest stressors. I have something to say both to the students and to the faculty on this. Suppose a student has 15 credits. Consider one credit to be 3 hours of work. That's a 45-hour work week. Many of our students don't look at it that way. They should know that they are being paid by their parents to get an education, and that education is a 45, maybe up to 50 or 55-hour work week, and they should be working steadily, not just cramming at the end, working steadily just the way the faculty and the staff do. If we could get that across, a lot of students may, who tend to procrastinate, they may not do that so much. They may learn to discipline how they work. For the faculty, tell the students how much work you expect of them. Monitor it on every assignment. Ask them how many hours they spent and show them what the maximum and the median and the mean were. And then find the students who took far too long, call them in, have them talk to you or a TA, and figure out why they're taking so long. You then have them on your side. I handle all regrades for tests and assignments myself because I feel the student who was asked for the regrade deserves someone with real expertise. I also treat late assignments leniently. And I'll give you an example of how this works. A student emailed me on Saturday and said she was having trouble. She couldn't get her program working, and she knew it was late. It was a day late by then. And she sent it to me, and I couldn't see the error in it just like that. So I wrote back and told her, I'm going to email you tomorrow when I have time. You continue looking for it, but don't worry about the lateness. Let's understand this assignment and get it right. And she wrote back and said, oh, thank you. You're the first professor who has treated me like a human instead of like a computer. I got that student on my side, and I can then talk to her about the way she worked on it, or he. If they had started 2 weeks earlier and done it the way I expected to them, they wouldn't have been in this problem. If instead what they did was wait until the last minute. So I have much more help for that student in acting like that. I'll stop there. There are other things. In summary, the big issue is for students to think you care. For instructors, remember that your course is not the only one they're taking. For students, you have work to do. Treat it as work and not just as a plaything to, I know most students don't do this, but there are a lot like that. Thank you.
I wanted to speak for a few minutes about the broader pre-med perspective as well as my own personal perspective with regard to mental health on campus. I think students from pre-med backgrounds have really embraced the idea of academic rigor at Cornell and treat it like Cornell's reputation is really something that they're proud of and in fact want to sort of flaunt to medical schools that they're interested in attending. And I could speak to that a little bit personally. I had the great pleasure of taking the 5-credit genetics course here and at medical schools, interviews, so forth, I've had multiple interviewers approach me and say, you know, what was that like? I've heard at you know at a different institution outside of Cornell, I've heard this is an incredible class, extremely rigorous, brutal. Students suffer through it, and so in that sense, I think that students want to use that to their benefit and say, yeah, I came through that. I came through that rigorous program. And so there's a bit of resistance among pre-med students with regard to revising academic structure of the university in order to address mental health. However, in my opinion, I think that presents a unique opportunity for the university to develop novel approaches to support networks. And one of those is, in my opinion, is through faculty support networks. And I think that can be done by, most importantly, merging the student community with the faculty community, because I think at this point they're very much separate entities, and we could do a lot to think of it as one larger Cornell community where students, faculty, and staff are interacting much more frequently. I've been fortunate enough to be a part of the Cornell Presidential Research Scholars Program, which is a really unique program that gives students, since their freshman year, to interact with faculty members to do long-term funded faculty-mentored research. And it's been a really unique experience for me to embrace the perspectives of different faculty members, and also just to become more comfortable working with faculty. And so as a result of being in the program, I've become more comfortable approaching faculty and talking to them about issues in my life or just about class topics. And so I think we need more programs with this goal of unifying the community, the student community and the faculty community, in order to incorporate a greater percentage of students than this Cornell Presidential Research Scholars Program can incorporate. In my opinion, our university would really benefit from the development of programs that facilitate any student interacting with any faculty member on any range of issues. I've had personal experience working with Dr. Rutledge, Tom Rutledge, in the chemistry department, who's really been more of a friend than a professor to me, even though I've taken two classes with him, two very different classes. But he's taught me a lot about pushing boundaries and taking the path less traveled, and that hasn't come through working with him in the chemistry lab or anything like that. It's been through outside experiences, seeing him at hockey games and things like that, talking with him about athletics and travel and politics, completely unrelated issues to chemistry. But he's sort of a unique professor in my mind in that he really goes out of his way to cross the boundary between the student community and the faculty community. For example, when I see him at hockey games, it's because he hires students to buy hockey tickets for him in the student section so he can sit in and amongst the students. And I think that's really incredible and noble of him. I mean, it's definitely a better place, better seats, but it's incredible he really wants to merge that gap. And so, in my opinion, these bridges are rare at this point, but further promoting these kinds of programs that would increase the connectivity between these two communities would be an enormous asset, not only to students, but also to the faculty community as well. Thanks.
So, my own personal stress is having a name that starts very late in the alphabet when you're on a panel, and all of your colleagues steal everything you were going to say. First, I'd like to thank you for inviting me. This is, I'm really happy to speak at an event like this. I had thought or had been instructed to talk about how in the biology curriculum we've worked to try and reduce student stress, but my own personal stress relief is I don't follow directions and basically misbehave, so I may get to that, but I wanted to make two comments first, which primarily agree with what everyone else here has said. The two important issues that I think aren't discussed enough is one is we look at stress in isolation, we look at academic stress. And in all of our lives, and especially in a student's life, in this time in their life, they're receiving stress from all different directions. So what you need to understand is you need to develop a relationship with a student such that you can discuss all of the multifacets of stress that they're experiencing. The place we need to get to is that you can sit down in a faculty member's office and the first question that is asked and is truthfully answered is, how are you doing? How is everything going? Because those are where you get the important answers from anyone, really. And I'll give you an example of that. A student who I work closely with all the time had suddenly just not been doing very well in their classes. And if you're only looking at what the classes are and talking about how to change that structure, you never would have got to the answer, because I just talked to them and said, how are you doing? And they said, well, I've been here 3 years and I just took the first exam that I scored below the mean. And my parents have called me and said they want to pull me out and send me to Rutgers. First, I'm sort of shocked by that, because if I made it to a junior as an undergraduate and the first exam I got below the mean was then, my parents would have been ecstatic. So I told them that, but it's not that we can change those student-parent relationships, but we have to understand them and talk to a student about those kinds of things. The second opinion I have is that we need a cultural shift at Cornell from where we are now, where we're a competitive individual evaluation structure in many of the things we do, to that every student's here thinks they're here because of personal development. That doesn't sound like much of a difference, but it really is. If, just like earlier speakers said, if you're doing an extracurricular activity and you know where you're going in your life, a B+ doesn't mean anything. You're structuring what you do in your experience to match where you want to be and how you want to get there. And right now, in the students' minds, even when the faculty don't mean it, they feel like they're in a class in competition with other people to get into med school, to get where they want to be. And that's not a good learning environment. You in the university are going to learn as much from the students you're taking courses with as you are from the faculty, and to isolate yourself from them is the worst strategy you could possibly have. So anything we can do to work towards that goal, I think, is a good one. One statistic, I advise many pre-medical students and write letters. I think a good statistic to keep in mind is that you have an equivalent probability of getting into medical school with a 3.5 and a 34 on the MCAT as you have with a 4.0 and a 24 on the MCAT. So you have decisions to make. When you're stressing about, oh, I've gotten the first A- ever, but you're not having your university experience prepare you for doing something like taking the MCAT or preparing yourself to be in that interview, you're not actually increasing your probability of getting where you want to go. So it's better to understand that moving yourself forward in personal development is much better. Within the biology curriculum, I'm the director of undergraduate biology, we have lots and lots of large courses, which are places where students feel stress. So over the past 4 years, what we've tried to do is first to reduce those course sizes. And when we can't reduce those course sizes, to make sure that students have the opportunity to either interact with a teaching assistant in groups of 20, or better yet, to interact with each other in groups of 5 and 6. And the reason we're doing that is to build this culture that we talked about with the previous speaker, in that we want to have a community such that questions like, how are you doing? Or, boy, I just really don't get this one part of that, can be asked in the format that works best for you. When you're not the kind of student who can raise your hand in that large lecture course and go, I know you've said it 10 times, but I just don't get it, you have the opportunity to talk to a TA in a small group. And if that isn't your style or what works for you for learning, you might have a chance to do it with other students. We are also working, it's very difficult, but my long-term vision is to make as many small biology courses available to freshmen and sophomores as possible. And I have some ideas. And if you have ideas, my email is easy to find. Thank you.
Well, you even stole my line, which was I'm the last person, and everyone said what. But what he said. I agree with absolutely everything that you said, even though I'm not the director of undergraduate biology. We were given three questions. I'm going to answer each one of them. I'll read you the question. How do you determine what constitutes a reasonable workload for students? That's simple. I just ask the students. If they think it's too much, I reduce it. If they say, well, that reading was fairly simple, I increase it. A syllabus is not something cast in stone or canonical. We're here to teach a certain amount of material or get through a certain amount of material, but there are many ways to do that. And I do it differently with 10 than I do it with 50. I do it differently in different classes, and I think student feedback is very, very important. And I think it's safe to say that most faculty trust their student feedback. I mean, there may be outliers, but the reality is that students will tell you what's going on. So thank you for telling me what's going on. The second question, what do you do, and then it says in parentheses, in terms of structuring courses, grading, et cetera, to reduce student stress without reducing academic rigor? I would change that to intellectual rigor. I'm not too happy with academic rigor. I understand what it means, but I think it's important to have an expectation that's not tied to performance. What I do, it's simple. I'm lenient. As Dave was saying, if someone is having difficulty handing something in on time, I'm not sure what on time means. If you have to write 3 pages, then I'd like to see 3 pages. If it turns out that you can't do it by next week, then give it to me the week after. In my class this year, I have 50 students. There's 12 written assignments. I tell them to number them so that I know they and I know where they are. And so if they've reached number 3 by week 3, that's great. If you've reached number 5, that's great. If you've only written 1, that's fine. As long as I get them all by the end of the semester. No one clusters them toward the end of the semester because people realize, and I think we all realize, that if we're given some control over how we can manage these things, then we learn to take that kind of control. I'm flexible with deadlines, and I also adjust load. So one of the things I've started doing in the last 6 years or so is I intentionally front load my syllabus in the knowledge that my colleagues aren't. And so I tell them up front, there's going to be more reading in the first 6 weeks than there's going to be in the last 6 weeks.
and at least on the syllabus. Of course, you should understand that we may not follow the syllabus, because if you decide that it's still too much, or if you think we should speed up, then that's what will happen. If you want to yank a book, put one in, whatever. I teach literature. Third question, how do you see the role of faculty in relation to student stress and mental health? I could go on for hours. First of all, I think that we should do things like this, and so I'm also very happy that I was invited, thank you. I think we need to get much more involved as faculty in understanding the issues. I think students do too, and I'm glad Vince wrote that letter with your colleague, your peer, I can't remember her name. She was voted in, but I can't remember her name. A letter in the Sun today asking students also to take a little bit of ownership of this process, which is exactly what's happened. I came back from spring break, Tuesday class, and I said to my students, what did you do over spring break? And that's what we talked about for the first 10 to 12 minutes, not the reading that they weren't assigned, because I hadn't assigned a reading over spring break. I'd said, the thing that was to be read over spring break, we're actually going to talk about on Thursday. Tell me about your break. Then we did a little bit of catch-up. We talked about some things that I said, you know, are there things that you think we didn't cover sufficiently? And it was a conversation. I do things like that. I guess the most important thing, though, is modeling, by which I mean everyone acknowledges that we're also under stress, right? Faculty. We have deadlines. Believe it or not, some of us have families and lives, right? So I expose that, right? I tell the students, oh, you know, over spring break, this is actually the truth. I was supposed to write an article that's actually overdue, and I haven't gotten around to doing it. And by divulging this, I'm modeling, right? I'm saying, well, it's possible to still be a functional and perhaps even respected human being and have missed a deadline, right? There are ways in which my life is a lot like your life. I have the benefit, well, some people don't think it's a benefit, but I have the benefit right now of being the parent of a 16-year-old and a 14-year-old. And I frequently say, you know, well, I have these conversations with my daughter in which we talk about grades or talk about whatever might be going on in her life. And I show that I'm actually personally committed to exactly the same principles that I am spouting in class when I say, for example, I don't care about performance, right? I care about your ability to read, your ability to appreciate, your ability to discuss this. I don't give grades. As it happens, I don't give a grade till the very end of the semester, and I tell them, I'm not interested in grades. Don't talk to me about grades. I won't talk to you about grades. Now, I realize Elizabeth Rosen wrote a letter in the Cornell Daily Sun arguing against this, and I see some of the virtues in being upfront. I'm just very upfront about it. And so when students say to me, how am I doing? I say, well, are you learning? Yes. Are you enjoying? Yes. Then I say, great. Then you're doing great. And if they say no, then I say, then I'm doing something wrong. And we need to have a conversation. Because I'm obviously failing. Right? I'm paid a lot of money to be here to do something. And if I'm not doing it, then we need to have a conversation. I could go on. I just want to say one thing. You evoked this this question of bringing faculty and students together. I'm a faculty in residence in a freshman dorm. When I interviewed for that position, I was asked, why do you want to do this? I said, because it's the natural thing in my mind for a faculty member to do. Seems to me that we should live in the community in which we teach. So I live with freshmen. I have for 4 years now. I've been a faculty fellow. I host a weekly dinner, a weekly brunch, Friday night movies. You're all welcome. This movie we're watching, The Year of Living Dangerously, this week. I do everything I can to meet students and talk to them. And my students are welcome to come. My students in my classes are welcome to come on campus. In fact, they do. And I also have started something recently called the Dr. T Project, which is a kind of class that meets once a week, but it's not a class. There's no credit. There's no grade. There's no assignment. There's no homework. Because I want to walk the walk, right? Not just talk the talk. I'm here because I want to share with you my love of learning and literature and culture and art. And so if you want to just come by and hear me talk about it, that's great too. Because I'm happy to talk about it without it being the thing for which I'm paid, as it were. So I think modeling is critically important. I think we're all here. I think faculty are here because they love to be here, because they love to teach, and they love to be around students. And I think students need to, through osmosis or otherwise, probably that's the wrong biological principle, I'm sorry, through chromatography, should somehow get that conveyed. And so I hope that I've succeeded in part.
Thank you to all of the speakers. We are now open for questions or comments, and there are some microphones around if you'd like to say something. You are limited to 2 minutes.
Hi, so this is more of a comment. First, I would just like to thank all the faculty that are here. I think it's really important that this involvement does include as many faculty as possible. And if I have one request for all the faculty in the room, it's take whatever you've learned here today, whatever you've gotten out of this discussion, or whatever you will get out of the discussion that follows, and bring it back to your faculty friends. Tell them what you learned. Tell them what you do that you think are good practices in class. Because honestly, I don't think that that communication is really the most important thing you can do coming out of this forum. And then the one thing I would like to say, and it was kind of mentioned in part, and I've seen it in classes, and I think those are the classes I get the most out of at Cornell, is you all recognize that you're not our only professor, you're not our only class, that we also have extracurricular activities that we do. And I think one way to engage us is to incorporate those into your classes, to show that you realize that, that you respect and honor that, and that you can bring that into your classroom. I know I'm in a class right now where leadership positions aren't just acknowledged, but they're given extra credit for that, for taking an initiative on campus, or for taking an interest in something that is beyond the scope of just our academics on this campus. And I think you don't need to give extra credit necessarily for that. I know some classes, every class is different. But just acknowledging, asking students what activities they are interested in on campus, talking to students about, interesting things they may want to look at, or just bringing opportunities to their attention. If a student thinks that you see value in what they do, and they believe that you're trying to add to that, I think they will see you as more than just their, professor. They will see you as a valuable individual on this campus, and they will respect you because of the respect you show them.
Thank you.
Once again, I want to second what Matt said. I really thank you all the faculty and all the panel for sort of sharing your thoughts and for coming. I just wanted to build on what Professor Sparks was saying. I think that thinking about learning in sort of a really multifaceted way and bridging sort of boundaries between students is like very important. And understanding that student life is sort of very very comprehensive and includes more than just the academic component and also the outside component. And in finding a way essentially to sort of acknowledge that in the beginning of class. So what I'm trying to say is that when a faculty sort of has the first class to sort of set a framework for the way they want to sort of think about sort of learning and also sort of see the faculty not just as a figure who the student should look for as a source of knowledge, but as a person who they can go to if they have any concerns and or things going on outside the thing. And that sort of, in my mind, has two benefits. First off, it sets a framework for sort of the way students can think about the class and their relationship with the faculty in general. But secondly, if a student actually is having a challenging time, they know that person is someone that they can reach out to. And I think that's something that's very important and that sometimes might not be said as clearly as it could be. Thank you.
Thanks. I'm Bruce Lewinstein. I teach in communication and in STS. And I just wanted to follow up on that bit, which is, those of us who make some attempt to be available for our students and are glad to, and sometimes worry that we've stepped a little too far, and my family has gotten used to being characters in my lectures because, but then I hear from students that they like knowing something about me as a person. Should I admit that Shacklot's daughter and my son are in the same year and go back and forth, my son watches movies, goes over to watch movies. but what I'm also surprised about are the number of times students don't take advantage of those opportunities. I have office hours every week, and my syllabus says office hours, whatever it is, 11 to 1, and happily by appointment. I see almost no students. This is in a class of about 130 people. Almost no students except when I've just handed back an assignment and people are unhappy with their grades. there are two or three people who've come in and I've had long discussions and I've gotten to know them as people. But I think that that's an important, that part of it is we have to show that there's not much of a barrier, but then we like the feedback too of people coming in and seeing us.
I'm Harry Green from Ecology and Evolutionary Biology, and I have a question for the panel. It might seem like a difficult question, so I'm going to tell you how humble I feel asking this. I received my draft notice in 1968, right before the grades came out for my last semester in college, and I learned then that I was receiving a D in folk dance, and for that reason I would be drafted without a college degree. And I went to the folk dance teacher and begged her to change my grade to a C-. She pulled out the grade book and did it just like that. So here's my question to you, with 30-some years of gratitude for somebody giving in to a plea like that. What's worried me is fairness to other students. So I taught intro bio here to huge classes for 10 years, and I did care about whether people were in distress, but I always worried about, what about the people who didn't come and tell me they had a problem, who just took the grade they got, and there were grades to be given at the end? So I'd like to know from either students or faculty or both, what about this issue of fairness when you make accommodations for people who express a problem they're having?
Okay, Shakat.
Okay. I was waiting for instructions. I should say that I've done that too. That is to say, I've been the person to change a grade for someone to prove a point. I increased the grade because they thought it would make the difference in admission to law school, and I said, I'll change the grade to show you that it doesn't. And it didn't. This wasn't a Cornell, this was at a peer institution. I'm very cognizant of that and aware of that, and here's what I do. If someone says to me, I tend not to grade assignments in the same way, and I've moved, my pedagogy's changed a lot in this way, but I guess the way I'd say it is, if someone were to bring something to me and say, I want to redo this so I can get a better grade, I usually have two answers. One is, what makes you think you're going to get a better grade if you redo it, right? And I say it as kindly as I can. The second thing I say is, you know, it's fine, but I have to ask everyone else in the class whether they want to redo it as well, because it would not be fair to let you improve, whatever that means, and not everyone else. But I don't feel that way about time management. So that if someone says to me, I need another week, I understand that, because I frequently need another week. Right? And so is that fair? I mean, at a certain fundamental level, it's not, because some people sort of had to do it within a week. But the problem is, I don't really say they have to, right? I never say to them, you will hand this in by the 9th. And if you don't hand it in by the 9th, you will pay the consequences. I say, I'd like to see this by the 9th. And some people get it to me on the 8th, and some on the 9th, and some on the 11th. And there's a certain fluidity. Now, if I do note in my little book, if something has come in 4 weeks late, 3 weeks late, I'll put a little L. And what I look for is a pattern. And if there's a pattern of lateness, by the middle of the semester, I contact the student and I say, you know, what's going on? I usually do it in person, you know, walking into class or however. And, you know, is everything okay? Are you having difficulty? I've noticed that you haven't had work from you. Sometimes they say, I'm really, really sorry. You know, I've been very busy with my other classes. Sometimes, you know, they avoid eye contact. And based on that response, I then try and respond. So I think there is a question of fairness, but I think it also depends on everything else. I mean, I think if there's a kind of culture of how one deals with that, and we all deal with it the way we think is fair, right? I mean, I wouldn't want to do anything knowing that I was unfairly penalizing someone or unfairly helping someone. But I'm happy to accommodate. And it's different kinds of things. Sometimes it's a religious holiday. Sometimes it's a personal crisis. Sometimes it's a health issue. And so you can't correct for that either. So it seems to me there is a certain latitude that we have but we have to be very aware of it.
Yeah, I think fairness is a very difficult thing to understand. I tell my students that yes, there is a total score based upon your weighted grades and the assignments and the tests and so on, but I can't just go by that. I have to know what I know about that student, and if the student is on the cusp of two grades and they have come to me and I know they didn't do bad, they didn't do well on a prelim because they were sick or some serious issue came up, then I will make allowances for that. If the grades start out high and then they go down, and at the end they're very low. I don't like that. But if they start out low, and then this person, perhaps because they're talking to people, understand what's going on and it gets better and better, I give them the benefit of the doubt. At the end, they know the material. So we can't just, you can't have fairness just by giving a number. That doesn't work. We have to take the students, their behavior, their environment into account. But I don't think I would change a grade because somebody told me they had to get into, they needed a higher grade to get into graduate school or something.
I was only 24 at the time.
Hey, Harry. I'll go on record.
That
saying,
is arbitrary and capricious, you know. Anyway.
I'll go on record as saying I will raise anyone's grade from a D to a C minus if it means they don't get drafted.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Now, if you needed a higher grade in order to stay out of the draft, that's a different question. Maybe I shouldn't say that.
And I want to see
well,
a folk
dance. I just
think
it's also one of those moments of advising. Why do you think you need that grade? I mean, if you need the C minus so that your parents can continue to get a discount on insurance that is necessary to help you be at school, that's very clear and matter of fact. But on the other hand, if you're thinking that you have to always be that A student come hell or high water and that someone's going to make you that A student even if you just because you see that as yourself, then maybe that's a time to stop and think, okay, well, is this really who I am? I have an Oxford doctoral degree with a 3.4 grade point average from Cornell, and I didn't get into Oxford because I had a 3.4 grade point average. It was because I was very experimental, trying out different things, and that's who I continued to be, and they found me interesting by the time I put in that application. And I think that's often true in graduate school, that if they're looking not just at the, you know, some graduate schools are just looking at the grade, but other ones, they're trying to see if they can see the human being behind that application. And if you're interesting and you're true to what you've been doing, it's going to show up, and you can take that lower grade. If it's true to who you are and you really did sacrifice that moment towards some other goal that was important to you. And certainly gives you a time with a faculty member where you can take that longer view of what you're doing.
Thanks. Hi. I just want to speak to Professor Lewinstein's point about office hours. I'm a senior and I still am intimidated about going into office hours at times. Just some professors make themselves seem like they're going to be easier to talk to than others. Oftentimes it's hard for me to get over that initial hump of what's it going to be like when I'm sitting one-on-one with this person and we're in their office and what am I going to talk about and how am I going to defend the fact that I didn't turn in that last essay and whatever. But something that happened to me my freshman year, which was actually at a different school I transferred here, was that I know this is possible for some courses, not for others, but I had a professor who made it mandatory to do a mid-semester check-in. And that was so important to me because the class was about 30 people and she just had us do 15 minutes each and she had notes about how many days we'd been to class, how many days we hadn't, just starting on a basis of what do you understand, what do you like about this class, what don't you? And it was just initiating the practice of what that experience is for a student to go into office hours. It's often really hard for us to know what our relationships with our professors are supposed to be and what's expected of that. So I think that I know that for larger classes that's almost impossible to do, but for the smaller classes I think it's really important for professors to do that and also understand that for students going into office hours is not always as easy as it seems. So I would, yeah, recommend that as something to consider.
Could I just comment on that one? Do you realize that many faculty are just terrible introverts? And we're intimidated by you know, office hours and having students and how lonely we get when nobody shows up. It's really interesting. So, you know, we do like to talk to people and to interact. And you know, many faculty are really introverts.
Could I just propose to colleagues that you also mix up where you meet with students? I meet students in the Two Naked Guys Cafe which is in the neighboring building. I 1 year I had office hours in the Live Cafe. It's not ideal. Sometimes the student needs to speak to you privately, but you know they'll usually tell you, I need to meet with you, or you can just go for a walk. Sometimes I've met just out in the quad and said, you know, anyone wants to come and talk to me, I'll be sitting and reading a book in the quad. And it almost then doesn't matter, in answer to your question, it doesn't matter whether they all do, because you've broken some ice, right? And you've kind of said to the student, you know, I'm willing to do this in a different way, and then the student can send you an email and say, you know, would you be willing to meet me in, you know, whatever, in the library or something. And I think that's a signal one can send as well as faculty, right? Obviously with large classes, this is much more complicated. But there are ways of making it easier, or having, you know, meeting them in the Ivy Room. I meet students in the Ivy Room all the time, so...
Hi. I think it's also important to remember that a lot of students come from a variety of cultures and have not necessarily been taught to go to office hours. And even when the professor tells you, well, my office hours are here, please come and talk about anything. A lot of students, when they come to this institution, they come for academics. And they haven't been taught to come to ask for help, to accept the fact that you might be struggling with something. And that's why I feel like Professor Shalkoff's advice is really important, because we need to find different ways to pull students in, because not all of us will just hear about, okay, there's office hours, so I can go talk about anything. Most of us, when we think about office hours, we think about, well, I don't understand this biochemistry problem, so I should have to go ask questions about it, and that's it. I think it's really important to be really creative about how exactly are we going to pull students in and how exactly are we going to try to get them to really go ask for help and accept the fact that we're not all perfect. We all have to struggle sometimes, and it's fine.
Hi, how are you? I think that we can all agree that mental health issues, stress-related issues in the classroom are obviously important ones, but... From listening to the comments of the professors and students on the panel, and even the professors in the classroom, it seems as though there are a lot of different methods, processes, ways of teaching, grading. And being a student athlete, one of the biggest issues that I have is consistency. How do we devise a plan? What's a strategy that we can employ moving forward that's going to provide some sort of consistency in students' lives, in grading and teaching, and how we sort of approach a student-teacher relationship? And so I'll put this across to the panel and even open it up to the floor if anyone has any ideas, but what's the plan, what's the time frame, and how do we enforce it?
So I'll bow to any of my colleagues on this one. This is tough. I think consistency, I think you can look at consistency in two ways. One certainly is consistency within a single professor. And that one, I think we can strive to be. We can strive to be consistent to treat all students in a very consistent way. Not exactly the same, not necessarily totally identically. Consistency across disciplines is really different. Different disciplines have different cultures at Cornell. So you ask what's the time frame? You know, I don't have a clue. You ask what's the plan? I don't have a clue. Maybe some of my colleagues might be able to address that, but there are really tremendously diverse differences across disciplines, which is, you know, it creates a wonderfully productive tension, if you will, and can be very stimulating. And I'm not sure that we want to homogenize all of that, but I would bow to my colleagues to comment.
Yes, I'm in the design fields, and it's a very studio-driven environment, and a lot of things don't apply across the board to other kinds of major, so I've generalized quite a bit, but you know, for us, the goal with someone in sports, for example, is can you do it at all given the demands of studio, and then just adjust where your creativity level is going to lie. So you can not get into a subject as deeply as you would if you didn't have the demands of your sport or your extracurricular activity, and then maybe opt in graduate school to go into a more deeper area of the field. But so the generality of that could apply across other majors, but I don't think that all majors you can lighten up on them in some sense of your investigation in quite the same way. And the predictability I'd have to agree. There's probably little that you could do consistently from the design studios that would apply equally well to humanities courses and computer courses or whatever.
And there's inconsistency in student attitudes across fields as well. I love listening to every idea to my left about how to handle a class, and I know on my right, a pre-medical student, I would suddenly up the stress by about 8,000%, losing that structure, because very much, especially as freshmen and sophomores, on the top of their mind is, I want to know exactly how I'm going to be evaluated. I want you to tell me exactly. I want to be able to go to your office and say, this is my goal. How do I get there? I know the medical schools want this. So if I was to say, well, get it to me when you can, I would suddenly have this huge stressful student body of 200 students. So I think we have to identify what those are. And then you or anyone of any majors spread across. You may take a course from me, and you may take a course from other people on this panel, and they're going to be substantially different. So I think the consistent thing is we need to make sure students consistently care about and communicate with their students is the number one thing. Those are the kinds of things we can work through, and they're cultural, and they require buy-in by you, and they require buy-in by us, and they require buy-in by the administration. And if we can do that, I think a lot of these things become smaller and smaller all the time.
Did you mean about courses, across courses, or did you mean our plan moving forward as a community to try and address these larger issues?
It could be something as simple as departmental,
right?
Yeah, for the science department or the biological science or the math department.
I had a conversation
to find some sort of, see if there's some way to find some sort of common ground. And you're talking about this ideological shift and how can we really start to take the necessary steps towards that. I think it's an important conversation that we have, and I really like your idea in terms of caring. it seems so simple, but it seems like everyone's really sitting on their hands waiting for the other party to make the first move, and I'm getting caught up trying to figure out why that is.
It's very important. I think there are certain things that can be implemented immediately. I mean, showing that one cares. Even if it's pretense, right? showing that one cares or expressing some kind of commitment. The problem, of course, has already been pointed out, is across disciplines, I mean, even within departments. And also, courses that are principally early, lower-level introductory requirement classes are very different from very detailed, in-depth classes. So consistency I know what you mean. I'm not sure it's the right word, but I know exactly what you mean. But what I'd also add is it's also one of the things I think we learn, I certainly learned it in college, is that things aren't consistent in life, right? So that I was watching the women's final game yesterday, and there are parameters. And those parameters are unchanging, unmoving. And, if there's a problem, then it's reviewed to make sure that everything is within a certain set of parameters. Certain other things, there are certain other kinds of contests or certain other kinds of interactions that are governed by entirely different set of parameters. So a conversation, right? And emotion and perspective and whatnot. And I think one of the things we learn, one of the ways in which Cornell is wonderful because of the different colleges, the very different college cultures and departmental cultures, is you get an experience of all of this. And so then the consistency then has to be something like, I would think, something like rigor, right? So you know that you're getting rigor from the faculty member. Communication, you want people to be communicating. Care, those kinds of things. And I think that's an excellent idea. And I think you should keep pressing us, the faculty and the institution, to have this plan. I mean, what is the plan? What can you deliver? Because we can't necessarily across the board deliver using metrics, but we can all say we are committed to our students. We are committed to syllabi that are transparent, this kind of thing. And I think that's important. And I think a lot of us are sitting on our hands, not because we don't care, but because it hasn't come up. And it's coming up now. And it's important that it comes up.
And I think it's important for students to always communicate. I find this all the time, that poor teaching should not be confused with rigor. Sometimes I talk to my colleagues and they say, oh, they just don't understand it. In the back of my mind, I'm saying to myself, that's because you're not really communicating the expectations very well. And we can't confuse those two things. And it's very difficult. And I think it needs to come from you as the students to say, as a group, not in a confrontational way, but we feel like we're not actually having the correct interaction here to actually assimilate that information. And, if it happened to me, I would like it, because that's the hardest thing to get feedback on in a course.
My name is John Weiss in the History Department. And we're talking really about, in a sense, two separate things, the matter of mental health produced by a mental crisis, and I just want to put that aside because I've been impressed by, in fact, how well the sort of deans and other facilities at Cornell do handle those crises. When I got my 3 a.m. call from a student this year, one of those and so forth, it was handled pretty well. So I want to put that aside to talk, although awareness of the facilities that are available is still something we should work on. We'll put that aside to talk about allowing students to better manage their workloads and also to decide, in fact, on the size of the workload themselves. Let me start that by saying one of the things that I've been doing for a number of years is asking students, sometimes I'll give them a prize, not with their grade, but I'll give them some kind of prize, for giving me a list of 10 ways, sometimes 5 ways, education at Cornell prevents me from acquiring learning and wisdom. And that actually started, it was started by, in fact, a student athlete who came up to me and said, you know, Professor Weiss, there's something about this place, I think they think that athletes are somehow, I don't know, incurious or not interested in expanding their universes because all the really interesting lectures that are given around here on subjects I really like to attend are at 4:30. Where are we at 4:30? We're out in the fields. We can't get to these lectures. And they don't tape them systematically. I can't find them anywhere and so forth anyway. So I think, you know, this is one way that this is something that I like you to work on. So I decided, well, I'll find out other ways that, in fact, Cornell students are bothered and not allowed to sort of either manage their work schedule or expand their work schedule. So that's one of the things that I have been doing for a while. In fact, I prepared a kind of a results survey of that for Jeff Lehman, but he wasn't here long enough for me to give it to him. So in any case, still I have that kind of sort of information on my mind. Now, as far as taping things that happen at 4:30 systematically, making them available, I think this is something that Dave Skorton could just sort of do and ask that it be done. It used to be done back when I first arrived here in the Jurassic period. In fact, you could actually ask for a something to be done. So that you might be interested, what's number 2 on the list of things that prevent me from acquiring learning and wisdom? I won't go down the whole list. I can't understand my TA's accent. All right, I can't understand what these guys trying to tell me. Okay, so that's another one. And in fact, universities do have programs for dealing with that. Cornell has one, in fact. But there are different ways of intervening and spotting, in fact, more quickly TAs who cannot express themselves well. So that's one. But let me suggest another thing as a kind of a tagline, which I could go on about, but I won't since we're at the end of the discussion here, and that is the new technological situation and being able to respond to that. When I started out here, the formula was you give 2 lectures a week, either a 50-minute wonder or a 75-minute wonder. You assign a couple hundred pages of reading and you discuss it in section. That's a history course. And that's the way you do it. And then you assign papers. If you really don't mind having your section interfered with, then you assign a prelim. Maybe I don't particularly believe in prelims, but anyway, you can do that. Okay. So this is the way it worked. Then you assign the papers. Okay. That's fine. It's a, and well, do students come to the lectures? Well, you know, you try to make yourself available, so you tape the lectures. You now can post them on the blackboard. So why does a student go to the lecture hour? What does he want to do? So your challenge as a professor with blogs, Blackboard, Twitter, WikiLeaks available, people sitting there with laptops with Google available anytime, they can check anything you say. Your challenge is to either make those hours which are supposed to be lecture hours useful, all right, in some way or other, or just give up on them. But certainly don't compel students to go to those lectures. And I have discovered rather recently, you know, sort of, as Marx said, the owl of Minerva spreads its wings at dusk. In fact, so I've learned rather late that, and some people, in fact, compel students to come to their lectures by offering pop quizzes, you know, surprise pop quizzes. Well, if you're compelled to go to lectures, do you learn the skill of teaching yourself something, managing your own workload? Do you learn really to become a mature learner? I don't think you do. So I think that I would sort of pose that out there as a way, as a sort of a proposition to sort of for all of us faculty to learn better how, in fact, to have students manage their workloads and decide themselves what's valuable to attend and what's not, what's valuable to study and whatnot.
John, I think we'd all like to get your list of those 10 things that prevent learning.
So. Bill, could I respond to that?
Mimeographs is not one of them.
But I've moved to a model where I tell students that I on the syllabus it says their attendance is mandatory and that they have to tell me if they're going to be absent, and then I tell them orally, verbally, I say, you know, it's very helpful for you to let me know whether you're going to be absent because I'll be worried about you otherwise, right? I mean, I'd be concerned if I don't see you, so I want you to let me know, even if it's after the fact. But one of the things I also say to them is, actually, you're adults, and I'm not going to take attendance. And you've got to decide whether you come to class. And I don't say it patronizing, I just say, here's the story. We're going to read stuff, and then we're going to get together, and we're going to talk about it. What you're paying for is the opportunity to sit in a room with me and all the other people around you to talk about that. You can just go out and buy the book, read the book, get the syllabus on these days online. The product, as it were, that Cornell is giving you is this opportunity. By not taking attendance and by emphasizing that it's a community of learners, I have excellent attendance, right? I mean, I only know this by looking, by surveying, because I can't prove it to you, right? Except on the rare occasions when I hand back all assignments at the same time, which I don't often do, right, in one batch. And that would be one way of me knowing that someone was absent. And I actually noticed this last week. And I summoned the student and I said, you were absent. He's someone I know. I said, you were absent. Is everything okay? And that's when he divulged to me that he had pulled an all-nighter and we had a long conversation. I said, meet me for brunch. And he came for brunch and I gave him the third degree about I don't understand. I mean, you pulled an all-nighter, but you didn't spend any time over spring break going to any of the movies that we talked about going to see. You were going to see. I mean, you know, you've got to have some kind of balance here. And so this a lot of it is also, I think, giving them a certain sense, and I don't mean this in any patronizing way, right? Giving students ownership of the class, right? I mean, this is my class. They call them my class. This is my class. I'm doing this. So it's yours, and it's yours to manage and to do with what and I'm here as part of that equation. So I think you're absolutely right. I think that people who give lectures which they can just recover in some other way, I mean, in those circumstances, why compel the students to go to the class? There's no reason to if it's all in the book.
I think we have time for one more before we quit. All of a sudden, I see a whole bunch of hands.
Hi, my name is Janice Whitlock. I'm in Human Development and Family Life Development Center. I thought I've been struggling this semester a lot with next semester whether or not to allow technology in the classroom. And I figured, it just occurred to me this very second that you guys are the perfect people to ask because we have a perfect array of people here. I notice, and I know that a lot of my colleagues notice, that I have a class that usually about 70 people, and there's just a sea of computers that over the course of the term get more and more. And even when I have guest lecturers that are absolutely riveting with some of the most incredible material I've ever heard, I still have usually last two rows of people buried in their computers. Multitasking and moving around. And we've had conversation in the class about whether what the students think about this, whether they think it's productive or not productive to be able to get access to the internet and to be compelled to do that. And there's usually a split with people saying, well, we're adults and we ought to be able to do that, and another set of people saying, I find it very distracting personally when my peers are doing it, and also that it's just too easy. And there is no way to turn off the internet in our room, which I think would be phenomenal if we could actually do that. So I'm wondering, I'm really struggling with whether to just say next year, don't come to class if you want to use your internet, if you want to use the computer. This is going to be a computerless class. Just keep it shut, take notes, and come if you want to discuss and be present and be with me. But I really struggle. So please tell me what you would recommend.
In the course I teach, many students have their laptops, and I'm up on the computer doing something that they can see on the screen, and they want to duplicate it and make sure they're getting it. So for that reason, I'm happy when they have their laptops. But there are always these others there who are just Googling and so on. Maybe you should reserve the last five rows for those people and say, if you're going to do that kind of thing, sit in the last five rows where you won't disturb anybody else.
The number one complaint I get from people in the course, the silent majority, is that it's extremely annoying for the people who aren't doing it. So I think that's an important consideration. A lot of it depends on how your room's configured and what's happening. In my courses, I usually say, just like the opinions put forward earlier, this is your job. You know, this, you should look at this like a job. So your reference point should be 5 years from now when I'm doing whatever job I dream of having, are you going to go to a staff meeting and say, I'm going to be Googling on my computer while I do this or not? And whether or not that's a direction you should be thinking about.
So one more comment on this topic, and then I'm going to ask for a question on mental health, which we will close with.
Now you got
So thank you all for coming. I guess I'm talk about a couple of things that you guys said that resonated with me personally. So Professor Grease, you know, you talked about like setting realistic expectations. I know Abby Cohn, she's on the Faculty Senate. She did kind of an experiment in her class where she kind of decided how long she thought people should be working on one of her problem sets, and then after they turned it in, had everyone write down how long they actually spent on it. And found that people who deviated away from that number, not only you know on the lower end that spend less time, but people who spend much more time on it, were the ones that were struggling in the class the most. And I think this is kind of a parallel trend that we've seen throughout the university of expectations between students and faculty, you know, not being met. You know, I think Professor Tawara, you mentioned this as well about just like soliciting feedback from students, and I think that that's kind of the main issue, is that it's never a two-way conversation. You know, and I think this is just as much, this blame falls just as much on students as it does on faculty, because we expect faculty to be doing things that benefit us and changing the atmosphere and you know, making changes that make life easier for us. But we never take the time to tell faculty what we need, what needs to be changed and how we're being affected. So I guess I would like to see, like, you know, I think this was a great event and really started a good conversation. And I hope that it doesn't stay at just a conversation. And I hope that we're able to leave here and actually, you know, continue this on and make tangible changes. And I guess, like, the last thing that I wanted to say was, I forgot who it was, I'm sorry, but someone said, you know, we need to push a cultural change in the university. And I think that's what it really comes down to, is that we have to end the dichotomy of this concept that it's students against faculty, and that faculty want to fail everyone and every student wants to pass a class, because, you know, at the end of the day, we all know that's not what it actually is. And you know, there are things from the way grades are issued to, you know, changes like when classes are able to be taken pass fail, or when people have to make those changes to their curriculum. And I think that there's a big host of topics that we can address. And you know, I hope that after this conversation, we take the time to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Roneel. I think we will. That was a mental health question. And I appreciate everyone coming to this event, asking questions, making comments, and thanks particularly to the panelists. So thanks all for coming.